91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. This hour we go back to days of Habana Viejo with veteran journalist Mark Kurlansky. He was based in the Cuban capital for years while writing for the Chicago Tribune. Good afternoon, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. Havana's history is five centuries in the making. It still has many features from that past. Historically, the city was a center for piracy and slavery. It was in constant turmoil with its Spanish occupiers, as well as resentful of U.S. domination and American organized crime. Today's visitors can still have daiquiris and mojitos, casinos, music, beaches, and more. Mark Kurlansky's book is Havana, A Subtropical Delirium. We'll speak in minutes after the news. Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman, it's today's Topical Currents, Wednesday edition. Thanks for joining us. This hour, we talk about the city both revered and scorned by the elder generation of Cuban exiles and immigrants, especially those in oh-so-nearby Miami. We speak, of course, of Havana.
The name stirs tropical images of music, dance, food, culture, revolution, and religion. With us now is acclaimed and prolific author Mark Kurlansky. He spent years based in Havana while covering the Caribbean for the Chicago Tribune.
He's written on a wide variety of topics over many years and many books, many discussed on our program. Those include salt, cod, paper, Basque history, the tumultuous year of 1968, and many more.
His latest is Havana, A Subtropical Delirium, and he joins us from NPR in New York. Welcome to you, Mark Kurlansky.
Hello.
Hi. Good to have you back.
Yeah.
So this book reads something like a love letter. Can you just fill us in a little on the history of your fascination with Havana?
Well, you know, it's a city that I first went to in 1982, and I've always just thought it was a great city. I mean, I love the Caribbean anyway, and it's just the great Caribbean city. But what happened was that Bloomsbury, publisher, has this series they've been doing for some time about cities. They get a writer who likes a particular city. They did one on Paris and one on Florence and one on Prague. And somebody had the idea, why don't we get Kurlansky to do one on Havana? So, you know, that's what it starts from. It's just, you know, my view of Havana as a city. And, you know, I have the sense that Havana and Cuba in general kind of gets missed in the political turmoil. Endless political debates, but not really looking at the place. So what I wanted to do is, I wouldn't say my book is apolitical. I think it would be impossible to write an apolitical book about Cuba. But it's not really about that. It's about Havana, the city, and it's a great city.
Have you been back since the relationship has thawed with Cuba?
Yeah, I have. I have. And I would have to say that I've seen greater changes in Havana. I mean, this is nothing like the change after the fall of the Soviet Union. That was a huge change. Mm-hmm. This is just, you know, I mean, there's some more Americans there, but you know, tourism has been huge in Havana for some time, even without Americans.
There's even more than in the heydays of the 1950s, correct?
Yes, much more. And I think the biggest year was something like 1957. It was under 400,000 tourists. And, you know, they're getting like 1.5 million now.
Mark, why the delirium in the title? To me, it kind of conjures up dreamlike of some sense, or...
Well, there's a couple of reasons. One of the reasons is that I wanted this book to be kind of steeped in an appreciation for Havana writers and literature from Havana. And in rereading all these great books, the word just keeps coming up. And And as I thought about it, there is something delirious about Habaneros, whether you're talking about, you know, the revolution or you're talking about baseball, the tone is the same. It's just it's how things are in Havana, and it's a city that is just embraces passion.
Well, tell us about your relationship as a journalist in Cuba. Kind of take us through those years.
Well, when I first went to Havana, when I first went to Cuba, it was in the Soviet years. There were very few Americans there, which was nice in some ways. You know, you were kind of a celebrity. An interesting thing is that through all of these years in which, you know, people have really suffered in Havana for U.S. policy, there seems to be no bitterness. I've never encountered any bitterness towards the U.S. And if you say you're an American, you know, they seem very happy about that, and they'd love to talk to you about various things. And just a very warm and open people. But when I was first there, the Soviet Union was basically subsidizing the revolution. And this wasn't the sense you got unless you thought about it. The sense you got was that, you know, the revolution was working. It was kind of an upbeat optimism. Things were getting better all the time. They were learning how to manufacture things that they lost in the embargo. They had goals that they were achieving. And everything was working quite well. Things were working, in fact, so well, they had no need for tourism, and they discouraged it. The downside of that is there weren't a lot of restaurants or hotels. But it was a very interesting place. There was just a sense of it being an experimental society.
Were you able to travel freely during those years? Did you encounter no difficulties as a foreign correspondent there?
Almost none. I traveled freely. I drove all over the country. I went all over the country seeing baseball games, and I drove to Santiago, and there weren't any problems with that. I only once had a problem with them, and I'm not sure what it was, but I was in my hotel room. The hotel room might have been the problem, because they always stuck me in the Habana Libre, which is this high-rise that used to be the Hilton, and it was just sort of loaded with their spies, and the phones were tapped, and it was kind of... It was kind of a sterile place because it was meant to be a casino, and there was no casino anymore. And I just went and booked myself into some small hotel. And I guess they were just wondering what I was up to. But one night, you know, there were only a couple of television stations, one of which has had incredible Cuban movies, great movies. I used to stay home sometimes just to see these movies. And the other had government information, which was, you know, helpful for a journalist. So one night, Fidel was giving a speech, and when Fidel gives a speech, this goes on for hours and hours. And I fell asleep. And suddenly there was this loud knock on the door, and they said they were the Interior Ministry. And I immediately thought, oh, they caught me falling asleep on Fidel. Why, how do they watch so carefully?
Mark, reading the book, I kind of took your advice, and I went back and I watched the great film noir, Our Man in Havana, with Alec Guinness and Burl Ives. Of course, it was shot in 1960 after the revolution, and you seem to like that noir setting of Havana in those days, in the late 50s.
Yeah, well, to me, you know, even now, Havana looks like a film noir. You know, it's got lots of deep shadows, and it has lots of color, but you could easily imagine it in black and white. And It's a. I say in the beginning of the book that if I wanted to make a film noir, that's where I would shoot it. Our Man in Havana, shot right after the revolution, has this wonderful film noir feel to it.
Even in the restrooms of the Sloppy Joes.
The restroom of Sloppy Joes, where the British intelligence makes their deals, which I think Graham Greene had that right. I think that is where British intelligence makes their deals. Sloppy Joes died and then was resurrected, and today looks exactly the way it looked in the film.
You've been quoted, Mark, as saying that food, I mean, I will just preface this by saying you at one point were a cook in your life and at another point a pastry chef. You've done more, you've had quite a protean career. You've said food is a central activity of mankind and one of the single most significant trademarks of a culture. So what does the food about Havana tell us about the Cuban culture or the food of Cuba?
Well, it shows that it's a society with a very complicated history and very culturally mixed. It's African and it's Native and it's Spanish and it's American, sometimes in the same dish.
Tell us more.
Cuba is not one of the great gastronomic paradises of the world, especially since they've struggled for food in recent years. They do have a great food tradition, both of seafood and farm food. When you eat Cuban food, you really get a sense of Cuban history. I mean, what does it mean to be Cuban? Does it mean to be Spanish? Does it mean to be African? It means all of these things, and at different phases in their history, different things dominated. Really through things in Cuban culture, more than Spanish, is African. Mm-hmm. And you see that in the food, in mm-hmm. the use of roots and in the frying and...
The maraquitas.
For example, yeah, or the kinds of stews, you know, because a stew always has the tendency to be, you know, a little bit of everything. A Cuban stew really has all those cultures in it. There's a clear American influence also. Sometimes I think the best food in Havana is the drinks.
Which you have a recipe for, recipes for in your book.
Yes, yeah. I used to, when I'd go to Havana, and about the first thing I'd do is I'd get a mojito. And I'd sip this mojito, and it would make me feel like I was in Havana. That was the taste of Havana.
How does it differ from one made in the States?
They tend to use the wrong mint here.
Oh.
Cubans use a native tropical mint, and here they tend to use a northern mint, which really has a different flavor, a different kind of mintiness.
We might not want to open the phones here in Miami right now.
Yeah, right.
Yes, and I have to say that the people in Havana tend not to speak well of Cuban food in Miami.
Is that true?
One of my friends who visited there said most of the people don't have enough food to be able to put together a media noche.
That Well, that's kind of an exaggeration, but there are food shortages at the moment, not as bad as there's been at other times. There is just this feeling in Havana. There's actually a feeling in almost everywhere in the Caribbean that when Caribbeans go to America, they become culturally diluted. You know, and I suppose that's true. I suppose that's always true about immigration. You can't stay the same when you're living somewhere else and living a different kind of life. One thing that Habaneros often point out about Miami is that Havana is a walking society. And nobody walks in Miami. Everybody takes a car everywhere.
Well, that's true. Unless you're on Southwest 8th Street.
I mean, I got to say, when I lived in Miami, that greatly bothered me because I was used to living in cities where you walked everywhere. You know, it's kind of an American thing, these car cities.
We're speaking with journalist Mark Kurlansky. He's an award-winning and prolific author. His latest book is Havana, A Subtropical Delirium. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back. We'll open the phones, too, and the email. Stay with us.
And we're back with today's topical currents, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, also author Mark Kurlansky, of course. We're talking about his book, Havana, A Subtropical Delirium. We're going to have a little bit of music, Mark. This is a classic recording, Celia Cruz doing Guantanamera live in 1967. Missing the video on this, though. Celia Cruz, 1967.
So,
yeah. One of the great things about Celia Cruz was that she had this Calle Hueso accent from this neighborhood in Havana. It's a famous accent. It's like a certain Brooklyn accent is to New York. You know, you hear her and you say, yeah, that's an habanero.
Tell us more about the music, the Son Cubano music of Cuba, which took, you know, it became kind of...
And known as a rumba here.
Well, yeah. And it became so widespread and influential in other countries.
Yeah, I mean, it's all African. It comes from African people trying to preserve their culture. A lot of this music, son in particular, was illegal in Havana because in slave times, and when you say slave times, you're talking about most of Cuban history because it didn't end until the 1880s. When I first started going to Havana, I met people who knew their African-born slave grandparents. I mean, that's how recently it was. And, you know, there was always this fear that, especially with the Spanish, that, you know, the Africans were going to rise up, and they would do this through their culture. Now, Jose Martí pointed out that a lot of this had to do with white guilt about how they've been treating them. But there was a certain amount of truth to it. There were certain uprisings that were connected with African cultural things. But, you know, music had a root in that world. You know, still dominates Cuban music. You know, hugely influenced rock and roll and everything else.
I have another recording, Mark, that you mentioned in the book of its importance in Cuban music. That's the El Manicero, And I have that by Don Aspiazo, 1930 at the Havana Casino Orchestra. You want to listen to a little bit of that?
And yeah, comment? Great.
Now, this has something to do with a peanut vendor, correct, Mark?
Yeah. It's actually what was called a pregón. This type of music was called son pregón. And it was the chanting of pregons were the chanting of street vendors, and this was the chanting of a peanut vendor, and
but it also kind of has sexual undertones.
Everything in Cuba has sexual undertones.
Okay, let's listen a little more.
No te acuestes a dormir sin comerte un poco rucho de maré.
El Manciero. Manicero.
Manicero. Mark, what is the music scene like there? Music availability, is it, I mean, like walking through the streets of New Orleans where you have people playing on all the street corners?
Better.
Better. Better. Different music. Wow.
Well, no, but more.
Okay.
You know, incredibly, most restaurants in Havana still have live music. So when you walk around in areas that have restaurants, and I mean good live music, great bands, sometimes jazz, sometimes son, but really good stuff. So you're just hit with, you know, one kind of music after another, plus the fact that people always play music in their homes. And if you're in an older part of town, the apartments don't have windows. They just have gratings. So you hear all this music coming out on the street from homes and from restaurants, and you really have this wonderful feeling. You know, everybody from Arthur Rubinstein to Dizzy Gillespie commented on this, how you just feel that you are in a place of music. It's just everywhere.
Let's open the phones. Our listeners, if you have memories of Cuba, maybe you've been recently, whatever the case, 1-800-743-9576, or you have a question or a comment from Mark Kurlansky. The book is Havana, A Subtropical Delirium. 1-800-743-9576, and email is radio@wlrn.org, radio@wlrn.org.
Mark, if an American tourist wanted to go to Havana today and just kind of went with a standard tour, what would they experience?
Well, you know, they have to go with a standard tour. It's a funny thing. People don't realize that the embargo hasn't ended.
Right.
And so you have to do exactly what you always had to do. It's just that Americans never realized you could do it before. You have to be, you know, with a group. So that's what everybody does. And, you know, there's a wide range of things that these groups do. Or, you know, you can break away from your group and do things on your own, and nobody will get particularly excited about that.
You have, you say they have still an ongoing love affair with Ernest Hemingway, which is interesting. It's still a tourist attraction. And then you wrote that because you have a big beard, you've been called Papa a few times yourself.
One time when I was in Havana, I got so sick of it, I shaved off my beard. I happen to be just about exactly the size that Hemingway was. And, you know, I have gray hair and a gray beard and, you know.
And also, speaking of the Havana language dialect, what is it they call? Your name, of course, is Kurlansky, but how did they call you?
Oh, I love this, and it shows exactly what Habanero is like. They always call me Gulanki.
Gulanki.
Hey, Gulanki.
For Kurlansky.
Right.
Yeah, there's no R's and there's no S's, you know.
Well, we're going to take a short break on our program. We're visiting with Mark Kurlansky about his book, Havana, A Subtropical Delirium. We'll be right back. And we're back. It is today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman, with author Mark Kurlansky. We're talking about his book, Havana, A Subtropical Delirium. Our telephone number, if you'd like to join in, 1-800-743-9576, or email, please keep them short, radio@WLRN.org. First caller, we have a Miami listener, George. George, go ahead. You're up. Hi.
Hey, hi, guys. I'm actually very excited about this show because you guys are talking about Cuban food and music, which I'm a Cuban-American singer-songwriter, and I just happen to own a few Cuban restaurants here in Miami, so this is right up my alley.
Well, how do you feel about Cuban food?
I have actually a funny story. I went to Cuba with my ex-wife a couple years back. We went to a couple different places. We went to Varadero, and in Varadero, there were three restaurants next to each other. I just wanted eggs, two fried eggs, and white rice. That's my favorite meal since I was a kid. That's what I wanted. I figured it was easy. We went into the first restaurant, sat down. I said, I want two fried eggs, white rice. They go, I'm sorry, we don't have any rice. I'm like, oh, okay. And they go, all right, but next door there's a restaurant. I'm sure they have rice there. So we went next door, and I said, I want two fried eggs and white rice. And the next restaurant said, sorry, we don't have white rice. And I'm like, oh, wow. And they go, well, there's another restaurant next door. Why don't you go there? So we went to the third restaurant, and we sat down, and I walked in first, and I said, do you guys have rice? And they go, yes, we do have rice. Sat down, I go, I want two fried eggs and white rice. And they go, we don't have eggs. So I went next door, and I got the egg, and I joined it with the rice from the other restaurant.
Determined man.
Determined man. Well, I thank you very much for you guys' conversation on this. This is fantastic. Actually, we have live music. We have a lot of Cuban people that come here and are looking for work that are musicians. I've hired a bunch of them. And I have them. I have live music every single night at my Cuban restaurant, which is Moreno's Cuba.
Where can I ask
where it is,
George?
Restaurant?
Yeah, Moreno's Cuba is on South Beach. It's at the Riviera Hotel, and it's a very, very cool, eclectic Cuban restaurant.
And when you say
Miami-born, you know, so it's a mixture between Wynwood and old Havana.
And the kind of music you have is Cuban music?
Yeah, we try to strictly stay to pre-revolution type of, you know, like nostalgic music. I'm not trying to do it for any political reasons. It's just for nostalgic reasons. I love Benny Moré. I'm a musician myself. And I love Celia, La Sonora Matancera, you know, even Los Zafiros, which Los Zafiros are after Revolution, but they are incredible too, and they play some stuff.
Okay, we have to run, George.
Okay, George, thanks so much for calling. Okay.
Mark, you might want to know, Mark, that we occasionally get letters from Cuban listeners. People are listening to WLRN on the island.
Oh, great.
They have some good antennas there. I'm sure
great.
Some of them are listening to
you. It's funny that when I first went to Cuba in the 80s, Cubans used to joke about how Americans listened to that, like the caller said, that pre-revolutionary Benny Moré and Guantanamera and all that stuff, and didn't listen to the Cuban music of the time, which was things like Los Bamban. And since tourism has come back, I mean, you just hear Guantanamera all the time now in Havana.
What would a typical tourist see today in Havana versus the real Havana? Or would they see that?
Yeah, well, you can see the real Havana. I mean, you can see a lot of different kinds of things. It's a big city with a lot of different neighborhoods, and if you just stay in Habana Vieja and a few places, you know, like that, you'll see something more touristic. But It's not, even that isn't a false Havana. And I mean, there's poor
right.
people.
You know, I'm planning to go to Cuba at some time in the future. And I have a lot of friends here who live in Miami who could guide me to relatives and that. Would I be able to get away from the tourist traps and get out into smaller towns and go to people's homes and things?
Oh, sure. Sure, absolutely. You know, Havana, you know, it's like New York or Paris. You know, it's not Cuba, it's Havana.
Right.
It's completely different from the rest of Cuba. So if you really want a taste of Cuba, you have to get outside of Havana. But in Havana, you know, also, it's really a relatively small area that's kind of the tourist area.
Right.
You mentioned Santiago before. How does Havana compare to Santiago? What are their differences? How do they contrast?
Well, you know, Santiago was the original capital of Cuba. But it was a mistake the Spanish made. It's the wrong side of the island. You know, when you're in Havana, you have immediate access, you know, by sea to the U.S. and to Europe. You're right on the Atlantic, whereas, you know, in Santiago, you're on the Caribbean. You have to go around through some straits to get out to the Atlantic.
Where did Columbus land?
Columbus landed on the wrong side. It's true. It took them a long time to figure this out. But Santiago is kind of an older city. It's a smaller city. And, you know, if Havana is the New York, Santiago is the Boston. This is particularly true in baseball, great rivalry between the Santiago team and the Havana Industriales.
Let's take another call. We've got Marcia in Fort Lauderdale, recently traveled to Cuba. Marcia, go ahead.
Yes. I just wanted to comment that you can go to Cuba independently. We did it 4 weeks ago ourselves. We arranged everything ourselves. We met many other Americans who, during the time that we were there, who were doing exactly that.
That's good to hear.
And so you do not need to go on a tour group any longer.
But you need a license from the State Department, right?
You do need, they call it various things, a travel permit, people call it a visa, but we were able to do that pretty much online. And you can essentially just do it at the Miami airport.
Well, if you go online and enter anything to do with traveling in Cuba, you'll have pop-ups for weeks after, believe me.
Yeah. We also have an emailer, Marcia. Cynthia just came back from Cuba last week, and she says her Airbnb was $30 a night. Her flight was $59 each way. Her visa was $50. It cost us more to board our dogs while we were gone than to go. And she says also we didn't do a tour. We did person-to-person educational. We made all the plans on our own. It was a cheap 5 days, and you don't need to be on a tour. That's what she also says, Mark.
Well, what does she mean by educational?
Well, she said we did person-to-person educational. I can only assume she means.
Yeah, I mean, I think that means that if you say you're going for educational purposes, I have to be honest, I don't exactly understand what's going on. I've always been able to go to Cuba because I'm a journalist.
Well, I was thinking about doing it that way, too.
The embargo, well, the problem with doing it as a journalist is then you have a problem with the Cuban government.
Right.
I'd much rather have a tourist.
And you can have the department knocking on your door, banging on your door in the middle of the night.
Right. But yeah. I don't really understand what's going on now, because I know that the embargo is still in place. So theoretically, you know, you can't go to Cuba for tourism. You can't spend money for leisure. This is all in the language of the embargo. But as these people are saying, people are doing it. And I don't really, I think you just have to use the right language to describe your trip.
Okay,
let's take another caller. We've got Pete in Delray. Delray, Pete, hi there.
Hello, how you doing? This relates to Cuban cigars and Cuban food and Bob Dylan. I was working in a studio in West Palm Beach, and he was in there for 3 days, and one of the days happened to be his 64th birthday. And when me and his crew sang happy birthday to him, they brought him in a box of Cuban cigars. And before this happened, they sent me out to the Havana restaurant in West Palm Beach, where I got him a Cuban sandwich, and I raced back to make sure it was hot when I got there. And it I just wonder, he has an obvious appreciation for their food and cigars. Do they have an appreciation for Bob Dylan in Cuba and American music?
I'm sure they do. I mean, they have an first of all, they have an appreciation for music and most.
And then there was the Pete Seeger stuff, too, with Guantanamera.
Well, yes. I mean, well, Pete Seeger popularized Cuban in America. He's the one who popularized Guantanamera in America. But no, Cubans do definitely have an appreciation for American music and for Bob Dylan and for, you know, the Rolling Stones are very popular there. Not that they're American. But
they did their big concert there recently, right, in the past couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, that was basically my comment and my question about Bob Dylan and if they liked him there. And I know he likes their food and their cigars.
Okay, very good.
Okay, thanks for calling.
Thank you.
And we'll move along.
That's the thing that's changed is that when you come back from Cuba to Miami, you don't have to hide your cigars anymore. I mean, you can bring cigars.
Yeah.
We have an email. Kevin says he's a longtime Miami resident, was in Cuba 10 years ago. He didn't care for mojitos, but couldn't get enough after trying one in Havana. He says, thanks to you, Mark, now he knows why. And he never had Ropa Vieja as good as I found in Havana Vieja.
Oh, yeah.
But back then, there was little food in the restaurants, which actually makes me think of a quote. Let's see if I can find it. That you wrote in the book, you said it's a popular joke. The revolution's three great success stories, healthcare, education, and sports. The three great failures, breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
Yeah, that's a very popular Cuban.
Let's take another caller. Mike in Kendall, you're up. Hi.
Hi, good afternoon, guys. I have a question for your host. I wonder if you could answer the age-old question between Miami and Tampa Cubans. Which is the real medianoche? Is it the one from Tampa with the salami, or is it the one from Cuba?
With the ham?
I'm used to the ham because I'm
from,
in Miami.
From Cuba or from Miami?
Well, if it's from Cuba, which is the real one compared to the ones from Miami or Tampa? Hmm. Because Miami's Cuban or medianoche is just ham and pork, where the one in Tampa, they add salami for some odd reason.
Hmm. That is odd. I've never had a medianoche in Tampa, and maybe I won't now. No, it's ham and pork. And actually, since I made that mean comment about Miami Cuban food, I'd have to say that the best medianoches in Miami are as good or better than any you can find in Cuba.
Okay, you've redeemed yourself.
But Cuba has better mojitos.
That's award-winning and prolific author Mark Herlansky. His latest book is Havana, A Subtropical Delirium. Our last break. We'll be right back. I think I know who this is.
Speaking of Santiago Cuba.
¿Y qué le hacemos, mamalú? Dame 17 velas pa' ponerlo en cruz. Y dame un cabo de tabaco magnífico y un jarrito de agua. Y dame un poco de dinero mayequeñe pa' que me da suerte.
Enter Fred Nethel.
Yeah. The thing that always amazed me about that, Stacy Arnaz, of course, is that the song that he's singing is about Babalu Aye, it's Santeria.
Right.
I don't think anybody in America had any idea that it was about Santeria or that it was African or anything about what it was about. He also uses the wrong kind of drum. He uses a Palomonte drum and not a Santeria drum.
Huh.
So I don't think he was.
I just
a
thought they
follower.
Were congas.
No, Santeria is a much smaller two-sided drum. But he probably wasn't a follower. You know, he was just sort of hearkening to Cuban culture.
Well, of course, Desi Arnaz went to St. Patrick's High School here in Miami Beach. One of his classmates, get this, Mark, was Sonny Capone. son of Al. They were friends.
Really?
Yeah.
See, so he didn't even have to leave Cuba.
No.
Let's talk a little about sports. How do I'm sure you heard of this smuggling ring. They've been evidently they're accused of. It's alleged a sports agent and a baseball trainer accused of smuggling Cuban baseball players into the United States. How do they feel about defectors
in Cuba?
In Cuba.
Well, it's very interesting. It depends on how and why they defected. El Duque, everybody was fine with, because he ran afoul of the Cuban government, was banned from playing baseball, so they didn't blame him for getting out so he could play baseball. Some other people, like Yonis Cespedes, they don't think well of.
Why?
Because... you know, he didn't have any real reason for leaving Cuba other than, you know, to make more money. And it's a kind of a sensitive thing, you know. I mean, they're leaving their country, insulting their country, really. And, you know, it's changing now with subsequent generations, but the original, you know, ethos of the revolution was to try to avoid being materialistic, and materialism was really looked down on. I mean, look, I've been to baseball games all over Cuba, and I would say at least a third to a half of Cuban players could make it in the major league and make millions of dollars. So to me, it's quite extraordinary that more haven't left.
Well, it seems to be. I mean, I was just reading about Jose Fernandez. I just wanted to see about his experience. You know, he's the one that unfortunately just died in the boating accident. He had three other attempts to defect. Each time he was unsuccessful, and then he served a short prison term or a prison term each time he had an unsuccessful attempt. So why would more come if that's what their fate is if they're caught?
The lure of money.
Well,
you can make a ridiculous amount of money. I mean, I'd be a Major League Baseball player if I could.
Well, wouldn't we all?
But, you know, it's difficult, and you see this in a lot of Cuban players. They come to the majors, and they freeze up for a while. And Cuban baseball, you're playing in a, you know, really like a triple farm team, you know, not the size of major league stadiums. You play for your whole life and for your hometown, which is why a number of people like Cespedes leave, because, you know, they come from a hometown that doesn't happen to have champion teams. You know, you're much better off coming from Havana. But they never, there's no trading. You always stay playing for your hometown. Mm-hmm. And when you play away games, everybody packs into trucks and they go with you to watch you in the game over in the whatever town. And so this Cuban baseball player in Fenway Park or Yankee Stadium, wherever he is playing before a bigger crowd than he's ever seen, and he doesn't know a soul. This is a huge psychological difference.
Okay, let's take Mark. What are they play? What are the kids playing in the streets in Havana?
Well, they still play baseball a lot, but soccer has taken on some popularity, and there's several explanations for that. One is that they're getting a lot more soccer games on TV. It's easier to get. They do have Major League Baseball games on Cuban television. I'm not sure how it's arranged through Mexican television, but not that many games. They're getting a lot of soccer games. So kids are, as soon as they started getting a lot of soccer games, kids started showing up on the street with beach balls or whatever to kick around. But I also wonder, because baseball's original popularity in 19th century Cuba was because it was American and not Spanish. And I wonder if they like the idea of soccer, a European South American game, not an American game. I don't know. Just something I wonder about.
Right.
Yeah. Let's take another caller. Vanessa in Miami. You've been on for a long time. Apologies. Go ahead. Vanessa, go ahead.
Wait, she'll come back. She's probably just left her phone.
Yes.
Vanessa,
hi, can you hear me?
Hi, Vanessa, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you so much for taking my call. So I was just in Cuba myself last week, and I can echo a lot of what we've heard on the phone. I did go on my own, took an Airbnb with my sister, and we did have a hard time finding simple things like café con leche, simple things like milk or Cuban coffee that we're used to here in Miami. And definitely the first Cuban sandwich I ordered, I was a little disappointed. It's definitely different than our meat-filled American sandwiches. But my question is, and I think it may have been answered, but perhaps Mark can direct me where I can get more information, is I was very much inspired by traveling there, and I realize there's so much misinformation. We've heard that on this program today. So part of the strength is, you know, I do speak Spanish, I'm half Cuban, et cetera, and I was wondering if Mark had any information or could direct me on how I can kind of start organizing groups or start taking groups or how to get involved more in like a tourist but commercial way.
You know, I really don't know. So many people are doing it that I gather it's not that difficult, but, you know, it's something that I've never done. I've been approached to take tours there, but I've never, I've never organized one. I don't know what to tell you, but I suspect it's not that difficult. I'm not surprised about your experience with Medinoches, but I am surprised about the coffee. Yeah, coffee is a really ubiquitous thing in Havana, and in baseball in Havana, in the seventh inning stretch, which is actually in the fifth inning, they serve coffee, and they go out.
No,
and
it was the milk part.
Oh,
we had trouble finding milk.
Maybe you were getting some.
Oh,
goat
well,
milk
that's
in
another
there.
Thing. You know, Fidel Castro was obsessed by the fact that Cuban dairies weren't productive and tried to make them more productive and to, you know, bring in Holsteins and they all died. And then he tried to crossbreed Holsteins with Zabus and they didn't do well. And
another five-year plan.
Yeah, well, there was this one. They produced this one cow that was incredibly productive, and they used to write about it all the time in Grandma, the official newspaper, and gave him an obituary when she died and said she had served the Cuban people.
Well, this has been a lot of fun this hour, Mark.
It has. Mark, you have been a playwright, having had a number of off-Broadway productions and as a playwright in residence at Brooklyn College. You've also been a commercial fisherman, a dock worker, a paralegal, a cook, and a pastry chef. As a journalist, you've been a foreign correspondent for the International Herald Tribune, the Chicago Tribune, the Miami Herald, and the Philadelphia Inquirer.
He's wearing me out.
Based in Paris and then Mexico, you reported on Europe, West Africa, Southeast Asia, Central America, Latin America, and the Caribbean. Your articles have appeared in newspapers and magazines, including Time, Harper's, New York Times, Sunday Magazine, Autobahn Magazine, Food and Wine, Gourmet. And you're also an artist in several media, including, I have to say, those pen and ink drawings which populate your current book and are really beautiful. You've authored over 30 books that have been translated into 25 languages, and the topics have ranged from everything you ever wanted to know about salt, cod, paper, the year 1968 to the Basque history of the world, to now Havana, a subtropical delirium. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you. So now people think I must be really, really old.
No, I think they think you're really, really talented.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And apologies to those callers we couldn't get to. That includes Travis and Scott and Julio in Miramar. Sorry. Topical Current's lead producer is Richard Ives. Today's technical direction by Michael Stock. Jason Zabka handles social media production, while Polly Landis is associate producer. It's about time for a siesta. It's easy to download and link free audio copies of each program at our website. That's WLRN.org. We also have the iTunes podcast and the Topical Currents Facebook page.
Or a cafe con leche.
This is Joseph Cooper with Bonnie. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Here and Now, next from NPR News.